Okay, thank you. Welcome to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners meeting on Wednesday, December 15th, 2021. This is a special meeting because due to the upcoming holidays, we have changed the date from the regular fourth Wednesday of the month to the third. This meeting will consist of three parts: Board Governance of Education from 2 to 2:15, Board Education from 2:15 to 3:15. We will take a 15-minute recess and reconvene at 3:30 for our business session, which will include an executive session to discuss performance of an employee. The session is being officially audio recorded, and times shown on the agenda are estimates only. All commissioners are present. As this is our special meeting, there is no approval of the agenda, so we're going directly to our education session. Today's first education topic is a debrief on our December 1st special session on regenerative governance. So, commissioners, what was your takeaway on that meeting? You know, we discussed quite a few things in there. We made, the possibility of quarterly regular regenerative session meetings, so that's one thing. Anybody else? Mari, you want to go first?
Well, on the whole, I think it was a good meeting. I think we discussed the subject quite fully, and I think it was a very positive meeting. And I'm quarterly meetings or not, whatever the majority feels, it'd be beneficial. And so that we can brainstorm and look at things as a in a generative way, that's fine by me.
Okay. Who wants to go next? Nobody wants to discuss it. We did decide also to discuss it at our retreat. Bruce, you're muted. Thanks.
I see that now. I think when we talked about quarterly meetings, I think I was probably the one that suggested that. But I think it would give us a formal way to actually talk about what we need to be talking about.
Okay.
I think that's very well put. that sort of sums it up for me. But I just want to say that I appreciate all of the time and energy we put into this conversation. I think it was wonderful that we identified, 22 areas that we could tackle in greater depth. I think we also came up with the realization that a big thing that the board might be willing and need required to look at is how we can support the public hospital district in whatever kind of bonding we need when we get further down the line of identifying the master plan. And if we are the elected board members from Jefferson County constituency, and if we're going back to that constituency to try to explain why we need what kind of support for what services and necessities, I think having us take a major role in that would be very appropriate and very timely. So I think it was a great session.
Hey, thank you. Matt, have you got any comments?
I don't have any comments at this moment.
Okay, all right. Well, then if we've exhausted that, and we will go back to that at our retreat somewhat, then let's go on now to our second topic, and that's the 2022-23 final strategic plan presented by our CEO, Mike Glenn. like. Thank you, Jill. Yeah. I think this is your third bounce at the strategic plan. The first one, I believe, was a three-year strategic plan. So this one's a little skinnier than that one. I think the second one, when I introduced it to you, was I also introduced the notion of moving from a three-year plan to a one-year plan because of the fog of COVID and the impact that had on our, I think, ability to really see 3 to 5 years out, and also maybe more importantly, ability to really kind of focus on what that might look like. And then when I presented that, we were probably 90% complete, but some of the initiatives, as you may recall, were under construction. Well, this document is complete. When SLG put it together, we were really focused on the most important things that we could do to measure and move the dot on. So that was our orientation. So the goal of this presentation is kind of as a final rundown and get any remaining comments or feedback you may have. Okay, next slide, please, Alyssa. So this continues to be our overall objective, to be the highest performing rural healthcare system and critical access hospital in the country. Next slide. Our goals to guide our community through the COVID-19 pandemic, deliver the highest quality of care, be a great place to work, provide services our community needs most, improve the patient experience, and remain financially independent. Next slide, please. So goal one, guide our community through the COVID-19 pandemic. First and foremost, keep our employees safe and well. I think when the pandemic was first introduced, 22 months ago, that focus was on finding N95 masks, finding appropriate surgical masks, understanding how we could monitor social distancing here in the at the hospital and keeping our employees physically safe and well. I think over the last 6 months, while that continues to be a focus, we have been equally focused on keeping our employees emotionally and mentally safe and well. And that, I suspect, will be a larger part of our focus in 2022. Provide preventive diagnostic and treatment services of COVID-19. That is intentionally vague because we will step into any void or any space with respect to taking of providing COVID-19 services that we need to. You may have heard that the pill treatment for COVID-19 diagnoses will likely soon be authorized. And while we don't know what exactly our role will be in that service, we will either facilitate that or step up and play a role if our medical leadership believes it can help our community manage through the pandemic. So we will continue to react where we need to react and do what we can to meet the COVID treatment needs of our community. Maintain accessibility of inpatient and outpatient services. That was a real challenge the last 3 or 4 months where we had to divert resources from surgery and focus resources upstairs on the inpatient floors on taking care of very sick patients for a while at the expense of taking care of replacing very sore and needed to be replaced knees and hips and other non-emergent surgical cases. So I suspect
as this waxes and wanes and goes from pandemic to endemic, we will continue to balance what we have to do to take care of COVID needs, as well as what we need to do to take care of non-COVID patient service needs. And then collaborate with public health and other partners to continue to put shots in arms, continue to support Dr. Berry with their masking and social distancing and vaccination requirements, and just be a good partner with some of the other players in our COVID work. Next slide. So the initiatives, ensure adequate supply and use of PPE, maintain a safe work environment, provide effective contact tracing for employees. COVID-19 preventive and diagnostic and treatment services, continue to promote vaccinations, provide therapeutic treatments, and support COVID-19 testing. Maintain accessibility of inpatient and outpatient services, promote prevention and pre-hospital care, expand the use of telemedicine, and design a system that adjusts based on community prevalence of COVID-19. Right now, it's when we rely on Drs. Harris and Mattern and Butterfield and Mitra Jafari, the chief of surgery, to sort of, for a while, make a week-to-week call on the amount of surgery procedures that require inpatient stay that we can do. So the more we looked at that, the more we thought, boy, it would be nice to have some sort of formula that helped us look out 3 to 4 weeks in advance, so that we could be more predictive to patients who are waiting for those procedures to be done. And then maintain an active engagement with Jefferson Public Health and continue to collaborate with DEM to continue to provide services for our community. And I'll just use this as another opportunity to give a shout out to Dave and the entire Department of Emergency Management's team for really grabbing the baton with respect to vaccinations and running with it. They have been terrific the last couple of months. So next slide. Deliver the safest, highest quality care. Next slide, please. I'll just go over the strategies one time and just go to this slide. Deliver care that's guided by the best evidence. Assess and address health equity. This will continue to be a big part of our work. Enhance the use of infrastructure, technology, data, and analytics for improving patient outcomes. That is a confluence of lots of work that's being driven by Dunya and her data team, Rob, and some investments that we are making in IT, and also Brandy and Dunya working together to get our analytic capability to the next level, so that we can use internal and external data to help us make better decisions and plan better for care improvements. And then promote excellent outcomes through the delivery of evidence-based care. We will continue to push or to encourage our medical staff leaders to promote evidence-based care protocols. Design the most effective performance improvement and quality management system. Ensure the availability and deployment of process improvement tools. When we first showed this goal to you, when it was a three-year plan, we were directed at or targeting really stepping back into a continuous quality improvement or a lean initiative process that we wanted to go house-wide. But we thought that was too ambitious for just this first one-year strategic plan. So in lieu of that, we are going to continue to push and make available process improvement tools and reintroduce some of those best lean practices. Next is enhance systematic approach to avoid medical errors, implement best practices in event reporting, investigation, analysis, and mitigation, and promote a learning culture by sharing lessons learned from system defects. It's amazing, and Brandy does this in her Team Steps course that we were planning, and we continue to plan to reintroduce in 2022. but it's this a module of could it happen here, and she goes over a handful of near misses that did indeed happen at Jefferson Healthcare. And the typical response is, we have systems in place that would never allow that to happen. And Brandy says, well, yes, but in this case, it did happen. And then begins a discussion about how it happened and the doubling down and redundancy or the necessary redundant systems to make sure it doesn't happen again. And it really creates this this open environment of talking about treating near misses as a jewel, as something to learn from. And we think that that's an effective way to stimulate that learning process. And then continue to transition to value-based care. Explore the addition of value-based contracts, that there's lots of work going on at CMS and CMMI and even at the healthcare authority. Our feeling is that once things begin to stabilize, that there will be a big push again to get all hospitals, particularly hospitals that are cost-based reimbursed, to move toward taking on more risk and being paid for quality. This is an area that Tyler spent a great deal of time at when he was at Kootenai, and with him and Dunya, and our physician leaders, I expect us to step more into this space, learn more about the different opportunities out there, and working with Washington State Hospital Association, maybe even offered a pilot some, because the healthcare authority and CMS are really anxious for hospitals to look for different ways to be reimbursed that allow us to continue to take care of our hospital care needs, but also make investments in the community as well. And then top performance in MIPS reporting. MIPS reporting is the reporting device that we use to track provider quality indicators that's required. Next slide, please. And next, so goal three, be a great place to work, recruit, retain, and implement innovative solutions to address current staffing shortages. This is probably our most important initiative. We are being as innovative as we have ever been to try to understand and track workforce shortages. It's not very difficult. The short answer is everywhere, in every area. That just raises the bar, I think, higher for us to figure this out. We also plan to offer on-site training programs for multiple positions. We've done that with MA positions, and we are challenging human resources to work with directors and other off-site learning institutions to see how we can do more of that. Because it used to be, even in times of staffing shortages, we would compete very well because of our community and because of the access to affordable housing. We don't any longer. So a huge obstacle for us now is recruiting an employee and then having that employee begin to look for a place to live and compare it to other opportunities. There's a couple of solutions to that. The one that we have more control over is look to see if we can promote more, grow our own workforce here in Jefferson County, which we've done in small doses, and we have plans to do in an even bigger way. Assess and track diversity in hiring and retention. This is part of our health equity work. I won't even say it's important. It's crucial that our workforce represent the demographic makeup of our community. And ensure total compensation is market-based. Total compensation takes into account your salary, but also all of the other benefits that are offered. And we have an extraordinary benefit package. So we need to do a better job of promoting that and having employees who are looking at Jefferson Healthcare truly understand what's involved in it, included in it. Next is reconnect to purpose and promote wellness of our team, develop and make available work-life wellness toolkits and other resources, create and complete an assessment tool to identify system healthcare fatigue at Jefferson Healthcare. System healthcare fatigue is what PhDs are calling just burnout, and I think it's more encompassing and it includes a level of disengagement that's far beyond what you do on a day-to-day basis, but basically what you are feeling with your own particular workstation, the work around you, your organization, and the healthcare system. So it's kind of a big deal, and could explain why there is a great resignation occurring in healthcare. So we want to proactively reach out, define it, and understand it to see if that can guide our work here at Jefferson Healthcare. Support and invest in our leaders, create a leader onboarding curriculum, create and require new leader orientation training, and partner with a vendor Huron for ongoing leadership development. We have signed the deal with Huron. A huge part of what they are going to do for us is put a formal leadership development track together that will begin as soon as January. So I will make a note to give a presentation to the board about what all is included in this. But one of the more exciting pieces is a leadership development institute, which is a quarterly 1 or 2 day retreat that takes all of our leaders through different best practices and leadership development skills and toolkits. If you've been working in healthcare long enough, you've probably been at an organization that worked with Studer. I worked with Studer, which was the pre-Huron. Huron was a larger organization that bought Studer and this program when I was at Providence in 2008. And I remember the leadership development institutes as being very effective and a great way to provide leadership tools, management tools, crucial conversation tools, managing the budget tools, all of the things new and experienced leaders need. And at the same time, they filled your tank with kind of inspirational, just time to be together on a regular and could be counted on cadence. So I'm really looking forward to that. Next, promote thriving and rewarding clinician practices. This is mostly going to be Joe and Steve and Tracy's work, mostly Joe and Steve. Identify and implement practice enhancement tools and invest in medical staff leadership resources. I think the medical staff leaders have the same need for contemporary leadership tools as non-medical staff leaders. And I think that we, as an industry, have under-delivered on that growth and development in years past. Our medical staff leaders will not only participate in Huron, but we are looking for specific tracks that help with that work. And then advance the work of transforming our culture. This has been a big focus the last 6 months of 2021. And again, Huron is gonna be very helpful in addressing this. But we've finalized the agreement with Huron and fully implemented the tools and resources aimed at transforming our organizational culture, and identify and introduce organizational development OD resources to Jefferson Healthcare's leadership team. Next slide, please. And next. Provide services our community needs most. Grow existing and identify new needed services. One is enhance our business analytic platform. This basically provides a better line of sight on things like the demographics of our community, what services community members are leaving our community to seek, doing predictive modeling that in 3 to 5 years with the aging of our community, what services may our community may need more, or maybe our community being less aging, what services will we need in order to continue to meet the needs of our residents, and there are all sorts of information programs that you can acquire. We are going to look at implementing a neurology clinic and geriatric consultative service. The reason that we called these two services out is one, as you know, they are very well needed in our community, and two, we believe that they can be just an extension of current clinics. We have very little additional space to stand up a new clinic or to grow a new service into. But we think that in the case of geriatric consultative services, that might be lend itself well to be an adjunct service in our primary care clinics. Expand cardiology services to include inpatient care support. Frequently, when we have a patient where we are ruling out MI, that patient has to be shipped to Silverdale because we just don't have the after hours cardiology support to provide assistance to our hospitalist team. So we think we can do a better job of meeting community need if that were the case, and increase orthopedic surgery market share. And our goal with our orthopedic surgery program is that for the orthopedic surgery cases we believe we can do very well here. We want to do more of those. We want to take care of more patients locally than choose to leave our community. And the existing team's doing a great job, and we have made significant strides in developing market share. But basically, that's the goal. We want to make sure that our community is aware of the services that we offer, the high quality and safe way in which they are offered, and to let them know that you don't have to travel to Bremerton, Silverdale, or Seattle to get your knee or your hip treated. Next is finalize the hospital replacement and campus modernization plan. We are probably 85% of the way through in selecting a design build team. Probably in February, the work of identifying the scope, scale, and estimated cost of what we determined to be the necessary building and replacement projects will begin, and then work with Jefferson Healthcare governance, medical staff, leadership, community leaders, and stakeholders, and the public at large to determine the most appropriate building replacement solution and the most appropriate way to pay for it. So as Case was alluding to at the beginning of the meeting, a lot of work in front of us to determine what it is we need to replace and to expand, and then how best to pay for it. And then promote population health and the community health improvement plan to improve community wellness, maintain and build new relationships with organizations that promote the community's health, and recognize the opportunity of anchor institutions and the impact they have on their community. Dunya and I have spoken with a couple of organizations that that promote anchor institutions to learn what the formal definition of that is, and if we felt that would be a reasonable thing to learn more about and then present to the board. And I think we will continue to learn more about anchor institutions in rural communities. Next slide, please. And next. Improve the patient experience. Remove the friction between our patients and their care. Friction is a term that I think Jeff Bezos came up with when he was just standing up Amazon. And you know, say what you want about Amazon, they have made purchasing really anything you want to purchase pretty friction free. So when we frequently look at how easy they have made it to order a book or an electronic item or whatever, and use that as our goal for our relationship with our patients. So we want to implement cross-location scheduling to increase access across different service lines. The simple definition of that is when you go see your primary care doctor and your primary care doctor says you're up for a colonoscopy, that colonoscopy visit at our general surgery clinic can be made right there at the primary care clinic. That those we have the technological connection made. It's just the operational connection which needs to occur next. And then two, enhance use of technology and analytics to connect patients with health services. That's a fancy way of saying that as the as people become more accustomed to doing their business, whether it be banking business or shopping on the internet, it's likely and possible and is being done in some communities that our patients would appreciate being able to manage and schedule more of their services for Jefferson Healthcare Services through the internet. Easy to say, a ton of work to make that actually more convenient than less convenient, but we understand that's what some of our patients would prefer, so we're gonna begin to understand that. Guide patients through every encounter, implement closed loop referrals and care navigation to support patients with transitions of care. We want to make it easy for patients to get from the first call to their primary care clinic to schedule a wellness clinic, and then all of the steps that may occur through that entire episode of care. Or episodes of care. That means a referral to general surgery. If it means that includes a referral to the laboratory and a referral to radiology, and then a trip to the operating room, and then a final visit back to primary care. We want that system to act like a system, and a ton of important pieces to refine. But now that we have the electronic interconnectivity, now we can begin to work on the operational interconnectivity. Advanced use of data and tools to monitor improved patient engagement. leverage the use of patient engagement data to connect staff at every level with patient feedback, create improvement plans, and adjust existing plans as needed. If I were to be completely honest, that I think probably our regular review of patient feedback that we send into CMS probably has been pushed out a little bit while we have been dealing with COVID and some of the other challenges it's placed upon us. When that system is working at its highest potential, you know, weekly and monthly, leaders have the time and the space to review the most recent data and feedback from those surveys that we send out to a percentage of all of our outpatient and inpatients. That has been challenging this last year, but we intend to step back into that. And then facilitate kindness and compassion through training and service standards. Personalize the patient or customer experience with every encounter through service standards and improve teamwork across departments. This is stuff that we do pretty well, mostly because of the quality of people that we that are in this community and the quality of people that we hire. So it's just a matter of training to that, creating expectations for it, and then watching it happen. Next slide, please. And then the last slide is remain financially independent. Next slide. This one. Implement a COVID-19 financial and operational recovery plan. Revise financial reporting to capture relevant COVID-19 financial recovery indicators. A good example of that is when we started really staring at emergency department visits, surgery procedures, those things that would begin to suggest that operationally we're climbing back. And I think this emphasis on monitoring cash, where we've always put that in front of you, but we are paying more attention to it now because of what we have lived through and the importance to have that reserve. And then monitor cash reserves to ensure days cash on hand stays above 100 days. Improve the value of services by increasing efficiency and reducing waste. You know, the last year or so, it's just been patching things together however we can. There really hasn't been a whole lot of management of scarce resources. I think that when we do come out of this, there'll have to be this shift from do whatever we have to do to adequately and safely staff the units, an unheard of amount of travelers, an unheard of amount of premium pay, just asking our employees to do heroic measures to make sure that we can provide safe care. Well, once we get on the other side of this, then we will begin to focus on best practices, which is fewer travelers, or if Tina Toner is listening, zero travelers. And in addition to that, just managing a premium pay to the extent that we can, because our employees would rather not work overtime if they didn't have to, and it stretches Jefferson Healthcare dollars, staffing dollars farther so that we can invest them elsewhere. So I think that work will continue a myriad of different ways. And lean on supply chain tools and partners to ensure adequate supplies while minimizing waste and contract spending. Again, right now it's this race to find whatever batch of masks, N95 masks, that you can get your hands on, and you're not really being a prudent shopper. Prior to the pandemic, we were prudent shoppers. all hospitals were. So I think when we come out of this, there will be a shift. I'm not worried about us having the ability to make that shift. It just will be a shift that that the entire industry will now have to focus on the fundamentals of making the organization work in a non-pandemic environment. And then maximize revenue capture rate by improving internal processes and working more efficiently with insurers. We're making great progress with this. Our revenue cycle department is advancing this work. We frequently talk about big dot metrics, kind of the big dot that you need to pay attention to. But typically there's dozens of smaller dot metrics that go to support the big dot metric. Well, the big dot metric is days cash on hand. And we talk about that a lot. And you've been watching that stabilize at a pretty high level. Well, what you don't see is all of the work and all of the processes doing things smarter that Joe and his team have implemented to deliver on that. Basically, just the difference is rather than the claims sitting out there and the dollars sitting in insurance companies' bank account, they are delivered to Jefferson Healthcare and sitting in our bank account where they can be used. So it's important work, and we'll continue to focus on that. Engage third parties to collect data and identify areas of improvement. We spend a lot of time doing internal benchmarking, but external benchmarking is just as important. We need to understand, what other organizations are doing and how they define productivity and efficiency, because that is what we will be asked, the standard that we will be asked to meet. And then create joint operating committees and meet with payers on a regular basis. in historically, providers and payers have had adversarial relationships, but it doesn't have to be that way. And I think that as we begin to move to risk-based, value-based agreements, that payers can, in addition to paying claims, they can also make investments in your community. Because if you think about it, we share that goal of providing care on the front end, keeping our community healthy and well, and needing less expensive care on the back end. So we intend to begin having regular meetings with our payers to see if there are some that may want to venture into those partnership waters a little bit deeper. Finalize a financial plan to support the hospital replacement and campus modernization plan. Tyler and his team have been fantastic in reviewing all of the of service line analysis reports to try to understand what services are in, what services aren't, and ensure cost report considerations are involved in the decision-making process so that we fully understand the impact to the cost report with how we choose to finance the project. And then, the most important goal, which is really stated in the strategy, and that is Tyler will lead the effort to determine the entirety of the financial plan for whatever we end up building. And then lastly, perform in value-based payment models. Explore and, if appropriate, recommend participation in at least one value-based payment model. That would be like an ACO. Many of the myriad of different programs and opportunities that either our public or private payers wish to partner with us on. We took a long look earlier in the year about stepping into another ACO, but our feeling was that maybe the best predictor of your future success in an ACO is the baseline year that they use to determine if you are moving in the right direction or not. And the baseline year for this particular ACO would have been last year. And our thought was, man, there was a lot of distortion in 2020. And we questioned how accurate some of that baseline data would be, you know, for months when we did zero elective surgeries. And therefore how insightful the data would be for us as we tried to make our way through it. So we took a pass on that, but as I mentioned a couple of other times during this presentation, we are pretty bullish on a value-based payment model. One, because I think the government is going to push us in that direction, and two, if we come up with the right methodology, it truly could be a way for us to take the same amount of reimbursement that is being allocated to this region and use it to make more investment in social determinants of health and health and wellness programming that will, in the long run, make our community healthier and more well and drive less expensive healthcare services. So that's it. That was probably about 90% of a redo, with some filling in the blanks. But I wanted to run it by you one more time and see if you have any comments or questions.
I can't hear you. Still can't hear you.
I have a question about the replacement modernization plan. How much and what kind of involvement has medical staff had on that? What kind of input are they going to give us?
Well, they were a big part of the master site plan. Jody got in front of them a couple of times and ran through a presentation about where they thought healthcare was going, where they thought healthcare in our community was going, asked great questions about, you know, telehealth. Is that something you see driving care in our community in 5 to 10 years? She presented the hard data of communities like ours with 28,000 people, a third of them 65 or above, would typically require 2.1 neurologists. You know, you guys have zero neurologists. Is this a service that your community needs? And yes, of course it is. And then the same question about pediatrics. And our provider said, corrected Jody and said, well, a bunch of us that we've got four or five doctors who are board certified in pediatrics and internal medicine. We believe we do have adequate pediatric care in our community and didn't need a pediatric clinic. So that input was very valuable. Recently, Jen and Dr. Butterfield, and I think actually they're going to have another meeting tomorrow where she's engaging the primary care leadership team to talk about one of the opportunities with this new project, and that is developing new primary care space. So they've had a couple of bounces with that, talked about the value of being more connected to their specialty care colleagues. And I think there's a second meeting scheduled tomorrow. But yes, lots more. They will be an important stakeholder, particularly when we start to talk about specific services. Do we need them? And secondly, what should they look like?
Thank you. Case?
Yeah, I have a question along the same lines, which has to do with orthopedics. You mentioned a desire to increase our market share with regards to orthopedic services. And I wonder if we have any data on what kinds of orthopedic service needs are the primary ones for which people are leaving the county. I know that we've been promoting the hips and the knees, but I wonder what the main ones are that are leaving.
Well, 7 or 8 years ago, our focus was pretty narrow because the way that the total joint replacement market share broke out was this was back in the days of Dr. Greenwald and McGovern. We did about a third. Harrison did about a third, and all the Seattle hospitals did about a third. So our thought was we need to understand why two-thirds of the community were choosing to leave Port Townsend for procedure that we did. Now, some of that, for instance, redos likely need to leave our community, or if the patient was at a higher cardiac risk, the patient likely needs to leave the community. But what we learned was that some of it was just lack of awareness or lack of understanding that that's a procedure that we do here and do very well. That was the initial focus case. To better answer your question, that recently we have been, and data from WISHA and the Department of Health is becoming more clear now to where we can understand the distinction of what's staying and what's going. So I think that will be instrumental in how we better understand. But I think the short answer is most of the cases that leave our community, frankly, are ones that should, that just require a higher level of backup and support care than we feel we can safely provide. Yeah, Bruce.
I guess a comment and then a question. So it's quite an ambitious strategic plan, a lot to accomplish in 1 year. But my question is, and I think I know the answer, is that do we have kind of a timeline for each of the initiatives, who's going to do what by when, so that because they're pretty broad and we want to accomplish all this stuff by the end of the year, but if we wait till the end of the year to see whether how we're doing, then some of those won't get done.
Yeah, that's what comes next, that Brandy puts together this real cool grid that connects the initiatives with metrics that we are measuring now and identifies what success looks like. And then the SLG team, we are a little bit more clear about who owns what. Currently now they're, you know, human resources owns people and Tyler owns finance. So there's those broad swaths, but that's the next phase of the work is boiling it down to what does success look like and who is the responsible party. It is a pretty ambitious list. There's a lot of double counting, if you will, Bruce, because it's work that we have started and are pushing on now. So it's not all fresh out of the box stuff. But it's a pretty ambitious plan for a year, no doubt.
Thanks.
Mari? You're muted, Mari.
So with the potential of increasing cardiology, cardiac support in the patient, maybe cardiac, would any enhancement of the anesthesia enable us to keep some of these orthopedic patients that in the future, I'm not thinking, you know, this in the next year, but further out from 22?
Well, I think cardiology, you bet. and
but with them on site, then would we be able to keep maybe more orthopedic patients, maybe with enhanced anesthesiology, an anesthesiologist, be able to keep more of those patients safely?
Yeah, I think so. Hospice team practices excellent care and is very cautious about making sure that we are prepared for, you know, nearly every eventuality, certainly one that you could expect. And frequently, if we had a little bit more cardiac support, that patient could indeed stay here. So that's the goal.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, so we'll get one more question.
You mentioned in there, I forget which slide it was, but it says transform organizational culture. Is there a simple way of describing what we're transforming from and to? I mean, I think it's wonderful to build a happy, cohesive culture, but I'm curious about the term transform.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a term that you typically see in strategic plans because it's more impactful than improve. But I think that there are two things driving this. One, if improving organizational culture isn't in every hospital strategic plan in the next year, that they are either fooling themselves or are unaware of what their employee base is feeling right now. Because I think it's just that's the state of where healthcare workers are right now, where this sort of disconnect between the workplace that is important to us, the workplace that we want to provide for our employees and our patients, and then day after day after day after day after day, patching things together because you have a higher than expected patient load and a lower than anticipated number of employees to take care of those patients. And I think the first 6 months, folks were, absolutely, we're here for our community. This is hard work, but it's rewarding work and meaningful work, and I'm proud to be part of it. The next 6 months, I realize I need to do it. I realize I need to be here for my community, but I'm getting kind of tired of this. The next 12 months, the social compact, I think, between folks who show up every day to take care of sick patients and other factors that contribute to why those patients are showing up is starting to fray. And I think people are starting to have a difficult time shouldering and burdening that. They're not starting, they have. We recognize that. And my feeling is that it has to be a thing, a very important thing that maybe just starts with talking about, using different tools to understand, and identifying the areas that we have control over and make them better. So that is our focus. So that's one. Two. I think that I've talked quite a bit about this, and particularly with Bruce has attended some meetings where we talked about this, that something happens to an organization when you go from, 400 employees, 425, 450 employees to 825 employees or wherever the hell we are now. And somewhere during that journey, you become a different place. So the decision-making processes, the leadership hierarchy, the communication, informal and formal communication methodologies that worked when you had 425 employees stop working aren't as effective. And we were beginning to recognize that right before the pandemic, and we had scheduled a leadership academy for all of the leaders to go through to begin sharpening tools and introducing new leadership tools and establishing behavior norms, how leaders communicated with employees or other leaders and the behaviors around that. Because I was beginning to sense that structurally and behaviorally, this was an area that needed more attention. Well, it's gotten very little attention in the last 2 years because our attention has been diverted. But the manifestations of that continue, and I think that they contribute to maybe having this workplace not be as spectacular as it can be. You're right in transform. We just want the culture here to contribute to people wanting to work here, even in the face of healthcare, wanting to work at Jefferson Healthcare, wanting to work with these people, wanting to work for these leaders. It's what we can control locally, because I'd like to think 6 months from now, this is completely behind us. But the possibility remains that it may not be. And we are going to have to figure out a way to keep 825 individuals fulfilled, doing meaningful work and important work. And I think working on our culture is something we can control.
Mike, I have a question. So being that our staff is overworked and feeling the burnout, and now we're going to ask them to learn new processes, are we making sure that the programs that we're considering are going to alleviate that situation rather than add another burden to it?
Well, we've talked about this, Jill. It's going to be a little bit of both. I think that when the work that goes into learning new skills developing better ways to lead, that's more stuff, more focus, more time. But I do think that the leadership team, and when I speak of the leadership team, I refer to the 50 directors, managers, supervisors here at Jefferson Healthcare. We spent a lot of time talking about this, and the consensus is that there is enough opportunity and enough necessity, a strong desire and willingness to make those investments. Because all 50 of those people want to get Jefferson Healthcare to a better place, in spite of the external challenges, and frankly some of our internal challenges. We will be mindful. We are deliberately slow rolling Huron, and the work and the tools that. That involves because of that, but I think that it doesn't start working until it starts working. Probably the second and or the second and third quarter of next year, we'll really be in the mode of learning new skills and beginning to normalize them, and I think it'll be for the better.
Great. Does anybody else have any questions, comments, Case?
Just a process question. I see that this says final strategic plan. Is this something that procedurally we need to officially adopt, or have we already done that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it needs to be officially adopted or not. It's certainly an element of work that the board is involved in. Can't hurt to be. It's better to be formally adopted when it's not necessary than not adopted when it is. So I would recommend that the board is comfortable to have the chair consider a motion to adopt the final plan.
And a second procedural thing, can that be done during this educational session, or should we do that during board business?
There is a question of whether or not we can do this, because this is a special session and it's not on the agenda. So we could do it in January at the January, or we could add it to the agenda of we do have another business session coming up. Well, kind of, it's on the 19th. We are having a special meeting, but if we added it to that agenda, we could do it. And that's for our board book and election of officers. So we could put it in there, and that would, I think, satisfy everything. Does that sound like a good plan? Is it more timely than that, Mike, that we need to do it, or are we okay with
that? That sounds fine.
Okay. Is nod your heads if you're in agreement.
Okay.
Okay. So I would say, particularly because we normally have a presentation and then have a little time to cogitate on it, that it would seem appropriate to do it at the next business meeting, maybe even.
Okay. Okay. Sounds like a plan.
All right, great. So if there's no more questions or comments, and at this time we will take our break, and we will resume at 3:30.
Thank you.
Thank you. Comments. Yeah. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay. Welcome back to the business portion of the December 15th, 1920-21 Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners Special Meeting. We'll begin with a patient story presented by our Chief Nursing Officer, Tina Toner. Tina?
Thank you. Good afternoon. I have sort of a short and sweet patient story today, and just for reference, this was a letter that we received just 2 weeks ago. So when you think about the last many months and the challenges of 2021, certainly, and to hear this letter about the care that was provided, it's a very heartwarming, touching letter. So I'll just share that with you today. I have spent 4 separate 2-week periods at numerous Las Vegas hospitals and skilled nursing facilities over the past year advocating for my oldest sister during her battle with COVID. Based on these firsthand observations, my assessment of these healthcare systems were shockingly poor. While her death may not have been preventable due to underlying conditions, the daily care she received by both doctors and nursing staff ranged from inadequate to unprofessional in the vast majority of instances. I returned from my sister to my recently purchased home in Port Townsend. 2 days later, I found myself suffering from a significant stroke. With my negative experiences with the Vegas healthcare system, I was hesitant to go to Jefferson. My severity of symptoms dictated that I had to go. I received excellent care, first by the ER staff and then by the hospital physicians. I believe they were Dr. Mendez and Dr. Johns. They shepherded me through the exams and tests with gentle ease while explaining each test in layman's terms. Dr. Mendez took the time to listen and respond to my fears about long-term stroke issues. I was then left with two fabulous ICU nurses, Holly and Ray. These two took care of me like I was kin. They were kind, caring, and attentive. Meds here, always on time. I was never lacking for anything, water, warmth, or comfort. They were always there when I requested assistance. While these were the four individuals with whom I had the most contact, I briefly interacted with others who also were kind and courteous, a complete reversal from my experience in Vegas. The professionals that work at Jefferson go beyond the necessary. They seem to genuinely want to have a positive impact on their patients. I feel very fortunate to now live in a community with such an extraordinary group of healthcare providers and first-class healthcare facilities. Thank you for your exceptional care, with special thanks to Ray, Holly, Dr. Ivan Mendez, and Dr. Johns. You are the best.
That is indeed heartwarming. We're sorry about the unfortunate experience she had in Las Vegas and her loved one, but we're certainly happy that she was able to come to us and receive that treatment.
Yeah, we're just so incredibly proud of our team.
Well, they do an excellent job, and I think it's so nice that they are acknowledged and thanked in this manner by someone from the community who's actually had the hands-on experience. We can say all that we do, but having someone like that compliment them and the entire service is remarkable. Yes. I hope that person is listening. Maybe or we'll know how much we thank her for that kind of letter and endorsement.
Okay. Any other comments? Okay. Thank you, Tina. And
thank you.
Happy holidays to you.
Thank you. You as well.
Okay, all right. Then we will move on to the minutes. We have the minutes of the November 17th special session, which was actually kind of our regular session, but special in that it was held off the regular date. And the December 1st special session for the regenerative discussion. Is there anyone who is willing to make a motion to approve this?
So move.
Is there a second?
Second.
Is there a discussion? All in favor then of both of approving both minutes as read?
Aye.
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 Okay. Thank you. And I see that was unanimous. So we'll move on now to required approvals. Is there anything anybody would like to take out of that? Okay, if not, may I have a motion to approve?
So move.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, thank you. And any discussion? Then all in favor, raise your hand so I can see.
Aye.
Okay, thank you. The motion passes unanimously. So then we move on to more interesting things, our quality report from our Chief Patient Safety and Quality Officer, Brandy Manuel. Brandy, you're on.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thank you. I will, let's see, Alyssa, you're going to drive. Okay, can we get the next slide, please? All right, so we'll take a quick peek at the quality and patient safety snapshot, and then we are going to talk a little bit about pressure ulcer prevention, and we'll follow that up with just a recap of our recent Department of Health visit before we end with the words of our patients, as we always do. Next slide. So taking a peek at last month's performance in patient safety and quality, we continue to perform well, even in the setting of really increased volumes across the house. You'll see that our zero avoidable harm dropped from pink the previous month to yellow this month. We did have one patient fall in an outpatient setting related to an adverse vaccine reaction. There was some temporary pain associated with that, but the patient ended up doing well. Otherwise, continue to perform well. Our readmission rates are below our target, and we didn't see any incidents of reported workplace violence, which is great. Next slide. So when we talk about a goal of having zero harm and we see zeros month after month, I think it can be really easy to take those zeros for granted. And I wanted to just kind of highlight one area of preventable patient harm that if you were to just look at those zeros across the board might seem kind of uneventful or like it's just habit. And I just wanted to share the work of a really robust team who's come together in the last year and a half to 2 years to make sure that we continue to see zeros on that particular score month after month. So we have a team that got together after seeing some inconsistencies in documentation and in the assessment of patient skin and presence of wounds. And that team decided to get together, work on some best practices, and see how we could tighten things up. So if we go to the next page, we'll take a look at what some of those are. So a list of interventions is kind of listed to the right, and this was over time. So again, this is over a period of about 2 years. The team came together. They looked at all of our education training, our competencies. They engaged some of our new graduates, which was a really neat thing to see. They implemented standard tools to assess wounds, and then they hardwired some of the tools that they had done. Our rehab team has worked really hard on making sure that patients have are starting to work toward early mobility, which is a key factor in preventing the breakdown of skin. And then they worked hard to implement communication strategies, making sure that the entire healthcare team was aware if there were any potential areas where there could be some skin breakdown. And then they looked at other sort of options for skin barriers and mattresses, some of the things that we use to try to prevent skin ulcers from forming. So what you see on the left-hand side is a graph that shows our performance. And again, this isn't a one or two quarter picture. This is actually reported out annually. So what you're looking at is January 2016 to August 2021. And in all of that time, there was one reportable pressure ulcer, which is pretty amazing when you look at that kind of in totality in that way. So a few of the lessons that we learned about the kind of project in general, there's definitely power in a team approach. Really engaging the team across the board makes a pretty significant impact. Communication matters. We find that when the team is not communicating about areas of risk for our patients, that there can be a lack of a shared mental model and there may not be as good a cooperation as there could be. And then reliability. So the prevention really does rely on the same tools and the same tasks being performed many times without failure, often in the same shift. And so I just want to call out, if we go to the previous slide, Alyssa, we'll take a look at that team. So Megan Brocklesby, Kara Ely, Andrea Armstrong, and Dr. Lemke, who really took leadership roles and just really took this project by the yes. They grabbed the reins and just ran with it. So I think I never want us to take for granted those zeros that we see across the board. Okay, next two slides. And then just a quick recap, we recently had a visit from the Department of Health. This was our state licensing survey. So these come about every 18 or so months, and it's associated with us just submitting our license renewal application. So this actually made our third official survey for the year. We had four surveyors who initially came. Two of them were clinical, and two were focused on more environment of care issues. And then followed up by the fire marshal. So a total of five surveyors. The survey was anticipated to start Tuesday morning and go all the way through Friday afternoon. The team actually ended a full day early. So they actually ended up leaving Thursday at about noon because they had seen everything. So after those days and talking to lots and lots of people, the issues identified are listed here. And these are considered preliminary until we get our official report from the Department of Health. We expect that we'll be receiving that the very first part of January. They have 10 business days to get that to us from the date of close, which was technically Monday, because the fire marshal visit came after the rest of the surveyors had left. So they found just in a couple of spots expired supplies. And in one case, it was literally a matter of just about a week. So the supplies had expired in November, and it was, you know, the first part of December that they had found it in a cart. And then food temperature inconsistency. So that was a situation where a sandwich had one sandwich was just outside the temperature range. The thought was that sandwich had just been prepared and put stocked in the refrigerator, but it hadn't quite come down in temperature from that travel. So that ended up being part of the report. We think it will be. We had a couple of policies that were outdated. So the Department of Health in Washington State requires certain policies to be available to the public and to the Department of Health. And so we list those policies on our website, and we also send them to the Department of Health. And what had happened is we had updated those policies internally, and we hadn't gotten the newest versions to the Department of Health. So they now have those. We had a sink and endoscopy that didn't have the etched line, which is how we determine how much of the disinfectant we should be using. So that Chris probably already has that fixed. And then the tap water up in ICU was too hot. So they've already addressed that as well. And then in the fire marshal report, this one came through on Monday. There were a couple questions about the report and the tag, so she's going to follow up. So I'm a little less clear on this one, but the one thing she did mention was just the use of personal devices and plugs in offices. So not in patient care areas, but more like in the administrative spaces. So we'll take a look at that. And just a big thanks to our survey team. It was a busy week last week. There was a lot of other sort of things going on. And Alyssa, Laura Showers, Kelly O'Connell, and Chris O'Higgins all played just a huge role. And everywhere we went, all of our leaders just did an incredible job. So a big thanks to everybody who was so great last week. Next slide, please. And as we wrap up, I always like to close by hearing what our patients are saying. And we haven't looked at home health for a little while. So taking a peek at this, again, this is reported out by quarter. And you can see the yellow line represents the top quartile, which is the goal that we have for ourselves in the strategic plan. And home health started pretty strong. And then there were some things, there were some staffing issues. And, you know, you could see the score that kind of dipped down. And then it has popped back up again. This represents the end of the third quarter. So seeing that move back up. And then looking at the comments, there were nothing but positive comments to offer. So some really great comments. One of them recognizing Stephanie specifically as a star who deserves special recognition. And in diving down a little further into the data to see where we might have some opportunities, it was primarily around making sure that they had a way to get their answers to their questions in the off hours during the evenings or weekends, and then making sure that they felt informed about all of their care and treatment. But the two areas by a long shot that were very high scores with a high correlation to this top box rating that you see above was around feeling that their providers really care about them and that that they had confidence and trust in their care providers. So I think definitely fun to see the feedback from our patients in that way. Next slide. And just a few of the current projects and focus areas that we are working on. A lot of work going into our emergency management, health equity right now, as we look at the strategic plan and think about what different activities will fall under those things. We got a lot of feedback from the shakeout drill that we spent last month kind of closing the loop on. So we're looking at just changing up the incident command room. We're looking at our communication and getting radios in. And then looking at overall training and readiness for our leaders. So a lot of really great work from the emergency management team. And just more of the same. So some of these things are on here month after month because they don't go away and we keep focusing on them. And then just the few new things, the ARCH Collaborative will end on Monday. That is a survey that we sent to all of our users to assess how we can improve our training and our tools and our support of Epic documentation. So in clinical informatics, we're really excited to see how that shakes out. And Rob, our new leader in information services, is leading that work, and he's doing a great job. He's been with us a full 3 months now, so he's getting his arms wrapped around lots of different projects and doing a great job. Next slide. I think that's it, unless there are any questions.
Questions of the board? Okay, well, thank you for the report, Brandy. It's your reminder of the zeros in those charts is a good one. We tend to look at the ones and the twos or whatever the numerals are and just overlook the zeros, and those are the hardest ones to get.
I'm sorry, I did have one question, if I might.
Okay, see it.
In the slide about wound care, there was a reference to some standard procedures, and the letters GHRQ, no, AHRQ, and I'm wondering what that stands for.
That's a great question. Thank you for asking. It's the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. So they have published sort of a best practice toolkit for pressure ulcer prevention, which was part of the toolkit that the team used for going about their work.
And do they publish other best practice guidelines as well?
They do. They do. You've heard Mike talk a little bit about team steps, and I've also talked about team steps. AHRQ was one of the agencies that partnered with the Department of Defense to start the team steps program, as well as many, many others. The antimicrobial stewardship program that we did a couple of years ago was also through AHRQ. So they've got several evidence-based practices that they publish for free.
Great. Thanks.
Any other questions, comments? Okay, thank you, Brandy. And we'll see you next month. Happy holidays to you, too. And then we will go on now to Tyler Freeman, our Chief Financial Officer, in the financial report. Tyler?
Hey, good afternoon. So since we have moved the meetings for November into December, just a reminder that we're actually going over October financials. So we're a little bit behind, but we have went over these topically with the full commissioners before, and we also did a deeper dive during the finance committee with two of the commissioners. So I'll probably fly through these a little bit faster, but the first thing I wanted to bring up, even though it did not happen in October, is the American Rescue funds that we received. So that's on the next slide. So we received the rural portion of the funding. We had to go through an application process. We did this in September. When we put in all of our funding or all of our information, it automatically submitted our application for both the rural portion of the funding and just the ARP phase four. There was some communication that went out this week that said that we should expect to receive our phase four funding by the end of this week, but we're expecting it to be quite a bit less. It's similar to this. The exact calculations aren't provided to us, but the averages that they provided in the press release were that small entities are averaging about an 80,000 payment. Medium-sized are about 290,000, and large entities are at 1.7 million. So we expect it to be less funding than we received for the ARP rural. And that is the funding for phase four is based on our lost revenues. There's some funky math that goes on with that, but it's actually based on our lost revenues over a time period. For the rural funding, it was just based on the amount of Medicare, Medicaid, and CHIP services that we provided between January 2019 and September 2020. we can use these funds to prevent, prepare, and respond to COVID-19, and also reimburse for if we don't have enough of the other provider relief funds to cover our lost revenues, we can also use this rural funding to cover lost revenues. All of our expenditures are going to be subject to an audit, so we do need to make sure that we comply, but we have been given very little guidance to date. So we're kind of going by what we can see on the FAQ and the press release as our North Star of what we can do with these funds so far. But we're also working diligently with our auditors, DZA, who are going to be doing the review of all of our federal funds in the upcoming year to make sure that we use these funds appropriately. And then there's a few other things that I wanted to point out based on the press release. So they mentioned that the reason for giving this funding out was that 47% of rural providers were operating in the red pre-pandemic. That is a huge number, and we are lucky to be in a financial position where we were not operating in the red pre or post pandemic. A lot of that has to do with our growth in service lines, and making sure that we're offering services that the community needs, and also we have a healthy mix of outpatient services. If we were just operating inpatient only and an emergency department, you can imagine how that would have really impacted our volume. So having the other service lines that we have that were able to remain intact and have visits really helped keep us in a good financial standing all the way through the pandemic, in addition to the funding that we did receive. The other thing that I thought was interesting, because as I said, there's not a whole lot of guidance, but they did point out that they're hoping that this funding will help healthcare providers keep their doors open, address workforce challenges, and make up for lost revenues and increased expenses. So that's pretty open-ended, and I think that we are going to be able to use the funding without a whole lot of restrictions. So we're hopeful that we have either one already spent the money, or that we will be able to by the end of 2022. So we have through December 2022 to use this funding.
Tyler?
Yes, Case.
When you say CHIP here, that is the Community Health Improvement Plan expenses?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, great, thanks.
Yep, so they were specifically looking to reimburse rural providers that serve those communities that are in Medicare, Medicaid, and CHIP. All right, any other questions on this? No? Okay, let's dive into October. So as I said, I won't spend too much time on this. I did want to point out, we went kind of line by line in the finance committee to go through how there's a lot of these statistics that look like they are, we're in the red. This would indicate that October was not a good month, but when you look through the revenue variance by department, revenue is actually quite high for a lot of these departments, even departments that have lower volume expectations than normal. So lab, pharmacy, CT, all of these service lines that look like they're low for the month, we actually did have solid revenue, and that translates to the income statement. I did also want to point out, it's pretty striking when you look at the comparison on that far right to October 2020 and how much higher we are for the year to date through 2021 than we were in 2020. So we've had continued improvement, and even though this first page wouldn't indicate as such, we did have a good month financially in October as well. So on the next slide, you can see our total gross patient service revenues were up 2%. We've got some movement in revenue adjustments, charity care, but net patient service revenue was up 6% for the month. Add that in with other operating revenue also being high, and we ended up being 8% over budget for the revenue side of things. Now for expenses, we were high again on salaries and wages. We did have some new hires that have their new hire incentive, their bonus for starting. We had some production incentive for RVUs that went out in October. So those two things contributed to high salaries and wages. Benefits still low because we're a little bit under where we expected to be for FTEs, and other expenses were high as well. And some of that was staffing related. So we've got some traveler expense running through. We also have some purchase services and some consulting and supply expense that was high in October. So overall, we were 15% high on other operating expenses, but total change in net position of $705,000, almost double what we budgeted for the month. And that brings us to 9% over budget for October year to date. Also a healthy margin of 3.3% for the month, and sitting at 3% for the year to date. So overall, a pretty good month. And if we move to the next slide, you can see that our cash position and days in AR are also holding strong. So with the Medicare advance payment that we've been paying back, we're sitting at 160 days of cash. Without it, we were at 126. And our AR days dropped down to 41.34. So all good things in the world of revenue cycle for the month. Next slide.
Amazing, Tyler.
Yeah, the team has been doing really great work, especially given, they have staffing constraints just like the rest of us. So team's been doing a great job, and we're definitely seeing a lot of the fruits of their labor. Board report, nothing to note here. We're sitting under budget in total, and nothing has really changed from the last time we looked at this. Next slide. And then I have one of these in for November and one in for December. So November, we're projecting to be over budget on the charges side at 102%. And pretty close to our cash collection goal. And that AR days held at 41.4. And then on the next slide, I have our December through today. So, there's going to be some holiday that's going to knock that 111% of budget number down a bit. But as of right now, we're sitting at 111% of budget for the projected revenue. And our average cash collections are quite a bit higher than our goal. So all good things. And then we will go over the November and December when we meet again in January.
Very good.
Great report, Tyler.
It certainly is.
Thanks, Bruce.
Any questions of Tyler? Comments? Other comments?
Yes, keep doing what you're doing, Tyler, and your fabulous department too. They should be congratulated. Well done.
Yes, Case.
Tyler, are you going to be taking a little bit of time off during the holidays?
Yeah, a little bit. I'll take the Friday off on December 24th to drive back to Central Washington. Be back on Monday, though.
We certainly deserve time off for your efforts. My gosh. Thank you so much such a great job and your whole team. Thank you. Happy holidays.
Thank you.
All right, then we will move on to Mike, our Chief Executive Officer, and our administrative report.
Right, thanks, Jill. So I will go through some volume statistics that you are used to seeing And then a couple of other items, and then turn the floor over to Dr. Mattern for a chief medical officer report. So next slide, please. So volumes, the call volumes that are coming into the clinics, and the testing volumes continue to stay robust. Next slide, please. Primary care continues to be busy at or around a budget, and specialty care clinics popping above budget. As you, I think, are familiar, we now have a second dermatologist working with Claire. So that's a that is a much anticipated and very appreciated addition to our team. Next slide. Oncology infusion continues to come right around budget, and surgical case variants to target data is there in front of you too. And Case Dunia broke out the hospital endoscopies from Jefferson Healthcare surgical endoscopies, and they were included, but Dunia's incredible data team is able to break them out. So lighter bluish gray is Jay's clinic, and the darker gray is hospital endoscopy, and the blue is non-endoscopy surgical services. Next slide. And this is the emergency department and express clinic volumes trending down a little bit over the last, although the last couple of weeks have popped back up. What we are experiencing more now, and Dr. Smith spoke of this at Medical Executive Committee last night, is more borders than we're accustomed to seeing. Border is a patient that needs to be admitted somewhere, but there's either not a bed upstairs, or not safe staffing upstairs, or not a bed in a Silverdale or Seattle hospital, or not a specialty care bed, or in some cases not transportation available to take the patient. So the patient continues to seek longer term care in the emergency department, which is suboptimal, but unavoidable if there's truly no place to send the patient. And when the entire system gets overloaded like it has been the last several months, this becomes almost the norm as opposed to the exception. So kudos to the emergency department team for not only taking care of the urgent and emergent issues patients bring to them, but also the longitudinal care of hours to sometimes days, supplemented by visits by the hospitalist and other members of the team. So that's a long way of saying, even though the numbers might be down a little bit with an increased length of stay, Kent would tell you it doesn't feel that way. Next slide. So I wanted to give you an update on interfacility transfers. This is kind of one of those important services that sort of falls between the cracks. So an interfacility patient transfer, an integral part of the entire healthcare delivery system in Jefferson County. Basically, they are when members of our community seek care at Jefferson Healthcare or are brought here by an ambulance and need a higher level of care than we're able to provide. So the first step in that is that we stabilize those patients, and then those patients, and then the house supervisor begins working with the doctor, and we determine where the best place for these patients to go is and where there is room. And then a transfer, a medical transfer is arranged. And then we arrange for a rig and personnel to execute that transfer. We contract with East Jefferson Fire and Rescue to provide this service. They are the primary provider for inter-facility transfers. This is a billable service. So East Jefferson Fire and Rescue bills those patients who have insurance, and Jefferson Healthcare provides a $100,000 annual subsidy plus ferry and other expenses. East Jefferson Fire Rescue has provided this service for many years. They do an excellent job, but frequently they have inadequate capacity in the way of personnel and rigs to meet 100% of our community need. So what we sometimes find ourselves in, particularly because it's on occasion we'll have 3, 4, 5, as many as 6 transports that need to go out on a day. And that would overwhelm any transport provider, which is completely understandable. But that 6 patient's needs are as urgent and pressing as the first patient's needs are. So it's a situation that we really struggle with. We are in discussions with East Jefferson, important partner to continue being the primary transport resource. We're also, like we do in other areas of care, want to have a plan for when the identified resource is overwhelmed. So we are reaching out to begin to identify what that secondary plan would be. So that there, when those occasions when we do have, and really it's any day where there's more than 2 transports, can be problematic, and for completely understandable reasons. Just that if it takes a certain amount of time to get to Seattle and back, and it's an expensive service to maintain, so there's a fixed amount of that resource available. But our overall goal is to provide the same level of transport responsiveness to the last transport of the day as is provided to the first transport of the day. And again, it's not a matter of the quality. It's just the capacity, the ability to meet all of the care needs of this community. So that discussion is going on, and we fully anticipate it to come to a successful conclusion, but the slight difference this time is Jefferson Healthcare has to have a plan for when East Jefferson Fire and Rescue is out of capacity, and I'm sure the house supervisors and the emergency room doctors will appreciate knowing that there's a plan B. In addition to the very fine service that East Jefferson Fire and Rescue can be counted on giving. All right, next slide, please. So I wanted to talk about the conclusion of something that I think is pretty exciting. Years ago, representatives from the Jefferson Universal Movement Playground approached us and with this idea that they wanted to build a playground for anybody and everybody. So if you're in a wheelchair, if you're ambulatory impaired, if the design of a typical playground doesn't accommodate whatever special need you have, this playground is built to accommodate, and it's a wonderful resource for a community to have. So when they approached us, we said, you bet, that's something that's on the target of our interest in improving health and wellness in our community. And they had like a million plus fundraising goal. So I said, if this thing takes off and you get to the point where you are close, we would be happy to provide the last $15,000 to get you to the finish line. And this was like a couple of years ago. Well, I heard from the county, who was sort of managing some of the fundraising for them, that they indeed reached their goal and needed our contribution. So I said, absolutely, this will be a fantastic resource. We would be happy to honor this commitment. And for that, there will be Jefferson Healthcare signage on the playground and other promotional banners and such to spread the word that we participated in it. So initially we thought it was going to be managed through an intergovernmental contract or a transfer, but John figured out a way to just fund the fundraising source directly, and that's what he did. So the board should feel good about Jefferson Healthcare's involvement in this playground. You can never have too many playgrounds, particularly one that can accommodate any kiddo who wants to go spend the afternoon having fun.
It looks like Bruce has a question.
Oh yeah, Bruce.
I remember, you know, hearing about this, like you said, a couple of years ago, but have they done a design and have they figured out where they're going to put it?
I don't know. They had preliminary design a couple of years ago. I was thinking what comes to my mind is Kerry Blake Park, but I don't know why that. Maybe it's
H.J. H.J. Carroll Park.
Yeah,
I think it's H.J. Carroll Park. I'm pretty sure that they do have a design. I don't know if there'll be any more tinkering, but I think that was kind of part of the budget that they've got it's pretty far along, is my sense.
Okay, so. Thanks.
Bruce, I'll see if I can get a schematic of the design and any other information that they have. I mean, truly, it's like over $1.4 million they have raised for this. So the community really galvanized behind it. I'll try to get information.
I remember seeing an amazing playground down in Paso Robles. And my son and I both thought, that's what we need in Port Townsend.
Yeah.
So I don't know if this is anything like that one down there, but it was amazing. And there were like kids of all abilities and ages there. And it was, you know, it's a bigger city, but
yeah,
it's unlike anything we have around here.
Yeah, it's a fantastic idea.
And I believe it's one of our former physical therapy directors who is one of the primaries in getting this going.
Yep. She was the one who made the ask.
Yep.
So good for her. All right. Well, I'm going to give the remainder of my time to Dr. Mannern for him to provide a chief medical. Oh, no, I guess I have one more thing. That the board book requires me or asks me to notify the board of budgeted capital expenditures over $100,000. And if they're in the budget, I just have to notify you. If they're not budgeted, I have to seek your approval. So these were the $100,000 plus items that were in last year's budget that we purchased. Improvada, a single sign-on feature of Epic, so that our providers don't have to go through repeated sign-on cadences in order to get on Epic. Our stereotactic breast biopsy device that arrived about a month ago, and I think actually we got some grant dollars to help offset the cost of that. And then some Stryker defibrillators, which we committed to, but we're in the process of purchasing. So thanks to Elena for reminding me that this is something that we do at the end of the year.
Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome. All right, Dr. Mannern.
All right. Well, let's do something fun before I get into like talking about COVID and stuff, which is let me see if I can share my screen. And I believe I've been able to pull up. If you see it now, can you see jump playground improvements at H.J. Carroll Park? Do you get to see it? Is it up?
Yes.
Yes, I'm sharing the screen. Okay, so you can go to jumpplayground.org and check the facility link. But this is the proposed structure, and it's using the space that is where I think the current there's a little bit of a BMX track and kind of probably gets into the disc golf area, but it's between the loop trail and the basketball courts, if you can kind of picture that in your head. So it's a pretty pretty large scale, obviously bigger than the basketball courts. And so so it looks great. So you can go and explore the website a little bit more if you're curious what we're supporting, but it's a really good project to be part of, and I know the people in the community have had a lot of passion for it for a while. So good stuff.
Thanks for pulling that up.
Yeah, no worries. So now talk about that COVID thing again. So we should talk a little bit about kind of where things are at. So we'll kind of go through a little bit of where we're at, kind of what's on the horizon. And then talk just a little bit about just, again, how it's impacting us, things are impacting us right now. And so you've probably been paying attention that the current rate of infections in the county has come down a little bit, but we're still in that stubborn kind of 150 to 200 cases per 100,000 per 14 days kind of range. And so we've really been stuck there for a while, haven't really been able to kind of get lower. The Washington state cases were trending down, but we're probably starting to see a little bit of an uptick just the way that we are kind of across the country. Starting to see a little bit of a national uptick, very high in the Midwest and the Northeast right now. Some hot spots in the Southwest as well. The Southeast has stayed fairly low. The West Coast has been a bit better. But again, with holidays and with Omicron, which I'll talk about here in a minute, the anticipation is that what we're going to see is that we're going to see cases surge again. Keep in mind that, I'll talk a little bit about Omicron, but really, Delta. So everyone's kind of so focused on this new variant, but the current variant, Delta, is still, causing 1,000+ deaths a day in the country, which is, as a society, I think we've just become numb to. But it's, we just crossed 800,000 deaths as a country. So this is still, so impactful. And when you think about the fact that, the statistics looking at possibly, looking around 1% of the population over the age of 65 have died from COVID in such a short period of time, it's pretty profound. Again, we have been fortunate in the fact of our community response and all the things that we've done, living in the oldest community in Washington State, for us to have had limited number of COVID deaths and to have the low rate of infections that we've had is very good. We're in a good spot that way. Right now, currently the state in Washington, around 1 in 300 people in Washington probably are actively dealing with COVID. Just to give you a sense, that number was closer to 1 in 100 a couple months ago. So we've made some progress, but there's still a fair number of folks out there who have infection. The thing that we've seen, luckily, and I'll knock on wood here, is that we were frequently seeing through the surge a number of people in the hospital at any one time with COVID. That has gone down, fortunately. So we actually haven't had as many patients in our hospital with COVID over the last few weeks. I think one of the things that's happened has been the adoption of booster shots. So one of the places that we should consider ourselves a little bit vulnerable as a community is that we don't have a lot of innate immunity. We don't have a lot of people who've gotten infected. And we had a lot of people who got vaccinated early on, which means we are a little bit at risk of waning immunity. And so boosters, and I'll talk more about that in a second. And again, you know, Delta is really the one that we need to worry about right now, and probably for the next 4 to 6 weeks, because that is going to make up the majority of cases. Yes, there's Omicron cases that are showing up, and those cases will probably double every 2 to 3 days. But for the time being, you know, Delta variant is what we're seeing. And we do have a broader base of data now supporting that boosters cut down on breakthrough infections, that cut down on hospitalizations, particularly in higher risk populations. So that really is the focus. So kind of turning our focus a little bit to the vaccination effort. You know, right now what we've done, you know, we put a lot of resources early on into vaccination, as you're all quite aware, and we've had to redistribute those resources to all the other medical care that we do. So right now, our approach to vaccination has been incorporating booster shots into other outpatient appointments. So we've not been doing using the express clinic or the emergency department for this, but we have been utilizing the primary care clinics and some of the specialty clinics in cases where patients are there for other reasons and they're looking for a booster, and we're incorporating that into the visit. We don't have the staff to be doing lots of separate vaccination clinics at this point. We just, and I'll talk a little bit more just kind of about sort of where we're at kind of from a staff being stretched. So we're incorporating at the same time, you know, the combination of that incorporation of booster vaccinations as well as primary vaccinations into our clinic workflows, coupled with vaccine availability through pharmacies, coupled with some of the DEM events, emergency management, who will be doing a couple more booster clinics upcoming. We're getting the sense that it seems to be fitting the need in Jefferson County. We did have a meeting today to reach out to public health to see if we can get a little bit of data. I have to admit, we have a little bit of a blind spot around booster reporting. It just is not something that we're getting data from the state. It's not easy to run reports in Epic on that right now. So we're a little bit, you know, uncertain, you know, how many Jefferson County residents are still need boosters and what the demand will be. But right now, at least anecdotally, you know, we're getting the sense that if folks really want a booster, that they can find a booster. We did a quick test of a couple local pharmacies to see if they have appointments available, and one had a couple of slots or a couple days of availability prior to Christmas, and another kind of between, I think, Christmas and New Year's and kind of right after the New Year. So there's appointments out there. People might have to kind of travel a little bit, or they need to be coming in for another reason. And then again, some of the Department of Emergency Management. So we think that we're getting there, and we're certainly seeing improvement in kind of the case mix. We're seeing of the patients who are getting COVID right now in the community, it tends to be a younger patient population. So we've had a lot of school age kids. We have a lot of families, again, a lot of household spread. Kind of younger groups is what we're seeing. So again, less likely to have severe illness, which is good. Not definitely, you know, it's not zero risk from severe illness by any means, but it definitely is good to not see as many high-risk folks who are having breakthrough infections right now. With regard to Omicron, and this is the big kind of unknown, and so you may have been following along in the news, and right now, the best we can say about Omicron is it seems to be more infectious than Delta. It seems to be spreading at a rate that's faster than what we've seen with the other variants so far. Beyond that, there's small bits of data, and we have to be careful to not draw too many conclusions. So there's some data to suggest that there may be some vaccine coverage, particularly with two shots and a booster of Pfizer, that you can get some protection. It could be that the Omicron variant causes less severe illness. It could be that it causes more severe illness in younger populations. So we're seeing mix of data. We're seeing, you know, some data suggest increased hospitalizations in under five in some countries. We're seeing, you know, kind of also in cases of, you know, in South Africa, maybe the hospitalization rate has gone down. We don't know what to make of that. And I think that's important that there's a lot of headlines out there right now. And, you know, people want to jump to conclusions and they want to kind of be ahead of it and kind of anticipate. The truth is, we don't know. It's going to be a really important next couple of weeks to see what happens, particularly with spread within the United States and sort of what it looks like within our patient population mix, what it looks like in vaccinated and unvaccinated populations right now. You know, some of the case reports are a little bit skewed. So take the Cornell University outbreak. It's a fully vaccinated university. So they have an outbreak of Omicron, primarily Omicron variant. So, you know, the headline will read, you know, Omicron outbreak among vaccinated individuals. Well, it's the only population you can infect, but you don't have the sort of if they have 900 cases, you don't know how many people were exposed and sort of what the breakthrough rate is. So there's a lot of numbers being out, you know, thrown out there, but without really kind of clear context. So where it leaves us is kind of still doing the things that we know are most important, which is get primary vaccination series, get boosted if you haven't been boosted. And I think that's the biggest push right now is to particularly for those folks who are maybe a bit more vulnerable and for people who've had vaccination more than 6 months ago, where we particularly see waning immunity, or people who had the Johnson & Johnson vaccine who don't have the same level of protection 2 months after their Johnson & Johnson, having a booster preferably with one of the mRNA vaccines. Right now in our clinics, we've been doing boosters primarily with the Pfizer vaccine, but we're going to be adding in a workflow to be able to incorporate Moderna boosters. We've been slow with doing both just because of medication safety. When you start getting kind of mixing and matching, we just want to make sure that we're careful with how we draw up and prepare, and we make sure that we don't make any immunization errors. So we're just being very cautious with that. So, but if you've heard that in the community of the, I wanted a Moderna booster and I, you know, couldn't get in the clinics, that was true. But we're kind of working on workflow so that for the future, if people are really kind of looking for a Moderna booster, they'll be able to get that in the primary care clinics. So, so that's kind of the main thing with COVID. Let me see here what else I was going to tell you. Oh, therapeutics. Let me also let you know what's on the horizon. Sure, Jill, you want to?
Well, I was along with vaccinations. What about, well, inoculations, but what about flu shots? Should we, do you expect that the season is going to be a little less this time because of the precautions we're taking, or?
No, I think we're all a little bit worried. So what we haven't seen influenza in the community. We have seen, and because we've been testing for this, we have been seeing RSV quite a bit, which is respiratory syncytial virus. It's a virus that oftentimes causes kind of bad cold symptoms in adults and older children, but in younger children in particular can cause pretty severe respiratory illness and wheezing, and is a known cause of pediatric hospitalizations. With school back in session and people kind of, you know, doing more normal activities, I think RSV is a little bit, seeing that activity goes up and seeing some other virus activity up in a way that we didn't see the year before, it's kind of a reminder that, you know, business this year is a little different than last year, and that influenza certainly could get a foothold to spread. And I'm a little bit worried because I think as a community, and we've dealt with this even with our own employees, to say, you know, don't be so sluggish about getting the flu shot here. Like, this is coming and is a potential problem. I think maybe last year or last time we talked, I can't remember if I had mentioned that there was an outbreak, influenza outbreak, I think, on another college campus. I think it was University of Michigan. So we're already seeing some, you know, outbreaks across the country. So activity hasn't picked up yet. Oftentimes it's not uncommon for flu season to kick in kind of after first of the year. So we've sometimes had some of our hardest flu months in February and March, in fact. Yeah, Bruce?
Yeah, I know that at least one of the pharmacies, you know, even though they have vaccine for boosters and for flu, they've been facing some of the same issues that we have, where people had made reservations to get vaccinated or get their booster, but they were short staffed, and so they had to cancel at least a couple days. So
yeah, you know, I think this is the issue, which is the supply, and this is where you know, and it's difficult because we're in the holiday season, and for the Department of Emergency Management, they find that, you know, when you're volunteer dependent, the holiday season isn't exactly the time that people are, you know, kind of as engaged to be volunteers. They have other things going on. And I think also kind of they get kind of some big events and then they get smaller response. And so it's hard to kind of figure out how to kind of gauge. But I've certainly the vaccines with the pharmacies is it is kind of, you know, week to week, depending on their staffing. So they might have availability. And, you know, one of the local pharmacies I walked into and they had a sign saying, no more shots today. We're not doing it. And, you know, it was just a paper sign made up. And you could tell it's probably, you know, hey, we're just, you know, this seemed like a good idea, but we can't just do it today based on sort of all the other work that's happening. So, yeah, so definitely for the folks who can travel more, and who can, you know, kind of maybe find an appointment, you know, out of county or kind of, you know, so in, you know, just across the bridge, we're over in Clallam, they have a little bit more flexibility, but you do have to, that's the thing, you have to have some motivation and you have to put a little bit of work into it. It's not completely straightforward. Again, if we can get you in the clinic, we've been able to kind of make it into the workflow. We just don't have a lot of extra capacity to create a additional lane right now for vaccinations. Do want to make a mention about some of the therapeutics that are coming down the pike here. So I think folks might be aware that the Merck antiviral pill went up for an FDA vote. It did receive a positive vote, but it was a closer vote than many expected. It was partly because the efficacy of the pill was not as good as the initial reports looked at. So the monoclonal antibodies, we are still doing some of that here. We're also referring some of that out. So our still main treatment for people not in the hospital are the monoclonal antibody treatments for people who are at higher risk. The Merck medication may fill a role for some folks. The Pfizer medication is looking more promising, and they released data that they're saying about 90% effective in reducing hospitalization in high-risk population. If that holds true and the side effect profile is not significant, that would be a game changer, and there's reason to believe with their report that that would be medication be effective, whether it's Delta or Omicron. Which is good. We're not talking about sort of spike protein here. We're talking about a different mechanism. What we don't know is when's the final approval. We think pretty soon. We also don't know really what the ability for Pfizer to ramp up production and get supply out. So even if we, you know, have this very effective pill for people in the early parts of COVID, probably in the first 5 days, you know, the question is going to be what sort of supply and access. So there's probably going to be a limitation to sort of who can get it. It won't be any COVID positive. It'll probably be high risk population early on. But it certainly has the ability potentially to really reduce the risk of people who end up in the emergency department, end up in the hospital, and end up dying from the disease. So we're eagerly anticipating that. There's another therapeutic, which is a long-acting monoclonal antibody that gives 6 months of protection. The data on that, there's a discussion about that's ongoing right now. The state is getting a supply. Our pharmacy will eventually probably get a limited supply. Probably look at use in the oncology department because it's really designed for people who are severely immune suppressed, or that's the authorization is for that group, which is to prevent COVID infection. It's another layer of protection. It's not in place of vaccination. So there's a few therapeutics that are out there that could be, you know, kind of game changing. But at the end of the day, vaccination, prevention is key. Trying to kind of rely on these things afterwards or, you know, kind of hoping for the best. And because we also don't know sort of side effect profile when some of these things get into the larger population. For example, the other problem with the Pfizer medication, which is if the side effect profile isn't bad, the drug has some potentially very serious drug-to-drug interactions. And so we'll require some careful consideration and instruction for patients. It's not just simply, I had a positive test and hand the medication over. There's going to need to be some thoughtful patient selection and instruction to make sure that a patient who's taking blood thinners or who's taking psychotropic medications doesn't run into trouble with potential interactions with this medication. So it's promising, but it won't be without a fair amount of work. So any questions on kind of other COVID things? Sure, Case.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the reports of myocarditis, particularly in young men, adolescent boys even. Mm-hmm. But yesterday from an acquaintance, I got a very sort of ugly looking cartoon that basically said that vaccines cause myocarditis. And I've searched the literature and the CDC for information on that and haven't been able to find anything about that. Are you familiar with any of that information?
Yeah, there is vaccine-associated myocarditis. And again, the issue is, you know, with vaccination, to never say that we don't have side effects or, you know, adverse effects. What's important to understand about myocarditis in general as a condition is that there's a wide spectrum of disease with myocarditis or inflammation of the heart. And what we know is with the mRNA vaccines, and particularly in younger men predominantly, but not exclusively, there can be women who develop myocarditis, is that typically after the second shot, oftentimes within a week, that you can develop this inflammation. Sometimes it can result in some changes in the echocardiogram. What we've learned about the vaccine-induced myocarditis is that it happens at an extremely rare rate. It happens and appears to be self-resolving in most cases, anti-inflammatories. There are some small cases of people being hospitalized. So it's important to recognize that it's happened. It's important to recognize if an individual receives the vaccine and they have complaints of chest pain, particularly within the week, and they have kind of difficulty breathing, that they need to be assessed and it needs to be considered. What also needs to be considered is what is the rate that the virus causes myocarditis, and viral induced myocarditis is a known phenomenon for a long time. And if you look at actual mortality studies in the literature around myocarditis, they're based on viral myocarditis, which is a very serious illness. And so then you ask yourself, well, what does COVID myocarditis look like? Well, it happens at a rate that's significantly higher than vaccine induced myocarditis. So it's important to understand that if you're worried about myocarditis, in understanding that at some point, all of us will come into contact with the COVID virus, really, unless you're sort of out, you know, in the, you know, tundra somewhere and living off the land, you know, in Alaska or elsewhere, you're probably going to come into contact with the virus. And what layers of protection do you want? And as a young person, and I have, you know, my kids, I have, you know, a couple of young athletes, and, you know, I think about sort of giving them the vaccine versus what would happen if they had the virus. And to me, when I look at the data, it's clear I would rather them have a vaccine with what's been established as self-limited myocarditis compared to the risk of viral myocarditis. In addition to viral-induced lung damage, viral-induced long hauler syndrome, possible neurologic effects, increased rate of stroke, I could continue. So the important thing is to acknowledge that, yes, vaccine-induced myocarditis is a thing. It's rare. And in fact, what was interesting is that when the approval came for ages 5 to 11 for the vaccine, what the advisory committee did was they actually modeled the rate of myocarditis in adolescents and basically took that and said, okay, let's assume that this happens. They didn't have any myocarditis in the study trial for the 5 to 11. They said, but let's say that you get myocarditis at the same rate. Would the advantage for decreasing hospitalization and decreasing complications from COVID be outweighed by the myocarditis risk? And the answer was yes. So again, for reducing the number of hospitalizations, reducing the number of deaths, because kids do die of COVID, and reducing the other complications, multi-inflammatory syndrome, for example, the benefit still falls on the side of the vaccine, even if you assume that kind of same high rate. So, you know, I think the key thing is that I'll never tell anyone that, you know, you can't have, you know, zero side effects or adverse effects from a vaccine, whether an allergic reaction or in this case, you know, sort of the unusual one. Johnson & Johnson, of course, had the blood clotting, has the blood clotting concern, particularly for women 18 to 50. So what's important to acknowledge is that there is a cost to not doing something. There's a risk. And again, in this is not a situation where if you don't get the measles vaccine, maybe I'll never run into I'll never run into a case of measles because I live in a, you know, incredibly vaccinated population. At some point, we'll all run into COVID. And the question again is, how many layers of protection do you want when you have that exposure? So, and again, the adverse effects and the risks of the disease is going to be greater than the vaccine at this point. So does that help?
Yep.
You can wind me up and get me going on certain things. So that was one of them. So yeah, Mari.
Well, I don't want to wind you up anymore, Joe, because you've been doing such a fabulous job. But I saw some research where mice had pericarditis, myopericarditis, as a result of not aspirating the syringe when giving the shot. Have you come across that research?
I know. I mean, I think, and again, sort of mice, I'm like, you know, I don't know. You know, it's sort of, there's all these. I mean, here's the thing. We have millions upon millions of people. It's out, the vaccine's out in the population. And, you know, I don't have hospital beds filled with people having vaccine complications or anything along those lines. What I have is hospital beds of people typically unvaccinated, you know, with severe disease. And the people who are vaccinated, unfortunately, are people who generally have difficulty mounting a significant immune response. And so they need the protection from the rest of their community to reduce their risk of exposure. So a couple other things. So, you know, it's interesting, you know, because we're not seeing as many COVID cases that are, you know, that's not what's, you know, dragging down the health system in the same way. It's not that we're, you know, at this point, Jefferson is not full with ICU beds full of COVID patients. Where we're at is, you know, staffing, energy, resources, people who've retired early, you know, it's the things that you know about already. And you know, we certainly are no more immune from in Jefferson County than in King County or anywhere else in this country. So staff is thin, and staff is also thin because, you know, cases in kids mean parents who have to stay home from work and who have kind of household exposures and things like that. And that's what's happening, you know, all around. We still haven't seen everyone kind of ready who had left the workforce ready to kind of dabble back in or commit to sort of more than per diem work in some cases. And what we also continue to see is a population that are trying to kind of make up for lost time in some cases, things that have the stress of the pandemic. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of mental health, we're seeing a lot of physical health issues that are that we're struggling to get caught up with. So the work is intensive, that is there, and there's a high volume of it, and our staffing is always on a thin line. And so at times you see kind of what we're doing with surgeries, which is sort of slowly, you know, adding some inpatient surgery or kind of volume of inpatient surgery. So we've kind of inched it up a little bit more. But everything's tenuous. You'll look on the schedule and you say, this looks pretty good, assuming no one has to call out sick or kind of take time off to take care of a loved one or to, you know, school doesn't close suddenly in their classroom. And so there's all these, you know, different, you know, factors that are kind of playing in childcare, elder care, you know. So it's just this cautious move forward, and it's really up and down. There's some days that we've got capacity in the clinics. There's other days where we've pulled back some capacity because in one of our primary care clinics, they walk into about 500 messages in the morning. I mean, you can just think about sort of what that takes. And so at some point, you have to kind of dial back to get caught up on the work. And so, you know, there's teams of folks kind of working on this. And so sometimes that's going to mean a little less capacity in one clinic or one service area, depending on what things look like. And it's just important to understand, for the community to understand that we're doing the best that we can. And we're trying to be as accessible. Home health and hospice is, you know, prone to the same staffing variation as the rest. And so, you know, I think the community has been really, I don't want to say spoiled, but they've come used to the, you know, hey, I got a home health referral. I'll probably get admitted within the week. If there's a hospice referral and it's an emergency, they're probably being admitted to hospice within 12, 24 hours. Those things are harder to do. And we can't promise that kind of level of service. It's not that we don't want to. It's just the reality in which we definitely have to. You know, on hospice referrals, I've had to reach out to a few colleagues and say, hey, we're going to do this as we can, but you need to make sure this patient's got the medications they need and some other things to kind of hold them over till we can get the team in the door. And people are just trying their best right now. And so it's just important to understand that, you know, you've probably all been used to me coming in and talking about all these different projects and things we've got going. And we continue to put a lot of stuff on the back burner or kind of slow walk some, you know, some different things. So there's a few things that are happening. We're kind of slow walking the MEC kind of realignment. Some of the Greeley work is still kind of slowly inching forward. And we're doing an oncology kind of workflow assessment this week. And we've got single sign-on has, you know, kind of restarted a rollout in the primary care clinics. And we're going to look at a state project on doing autism evaluations in with some support from the University of Washington and DOH. So we've got an education on that. And we're gearing up for state law around naloxone distribution for opioid use disorder in the emergency department and at the time of discharge, and instructions and streamlining our referral into medically assisted treatment. So, you know, I got no shortage of list of projects, but some of the stuff that we probably would have put to bed, you know, weeks or months ago, just kind of is not finishing at the same pace. So just for you all to be aware that it's not that there's not interest. It's just that bandwidth is limited. So things are just happening at a slower pace. So any other questions about things? I'm happy to say that right now we're in a, you know, I'll knock on wood, but from a physician and advanced practice clinician staffing standpoint, you know, we've been really in good shape through the pandemic, actually, and that continues to be true. We even added the dermatologist as our new dermatologist, as Mike had mentioned. So we've been fortunate that way. But, you know, staff is stretched, and we're trying to be careful and not push too hard in areas where they just they need a little bit of space and capacity. Yeah, Case.
Yeah, you mentioned MAT, treatment for opioid addiction. Can you say anything about the new center that's going up in Sequim and how that's going to be staffed and or our relationship with that, how that's going to be used?
Yeah, we were supportive, and we haven't actually had a chance to circle back. Some of the countywide or the three county opioid work has, again, we haven't been able to participate in the same way through the pandemic, and that's kind of how I stayed connected with that. Luckily, I get to see Allison, and I know she's been Jamestown's been, you know, connected with that work. But it's actually a reminder, we actually need to circle back to see where things are. I mean, you know, our support behind that project was partly because it was identified to be a resource that would serve beyond Clallam County. And so we haven't really had a chance to sort of circle back and kind of talk with the folks to see sort of where things are at. You know, we've got our MAT navigator who has been primarily focused on opioid use disorder. She's beginning to move towards maybe helping with alcohol use disorder, which is great. We've got the emergency department providers are bought into. We're trying to streamline the referral process. So if they identify someone at risk or identify someone who has a known opioid use disorder, for example, a patient who comes in with overdose, the referral and the handoff for MAT navigator to reach and try to get that person into treatment in the primary care clinic. So we've mostly been focusing kind of internally on just fine tuning some of the work, the actual distribution of naloxone in the ED, which will be identified patients will actually go home with the Narcan syringe as opposed to having to pick it up at a pharmacy. That'll be a new. So we've been doing that kind of work, but we have to circle back. It's a good reminder that, you know, we've kind of, you know, somewhere in the back of our mind, we're like, hey, they've got that project going. And so I don't know kind of what their timeline is at this point of opening, and we need to probably reconnect.
Yeah, I heard it was in March or April.
Oh, yeah. I'll have to follow up and see. Because, yeah, my thought would be that, particularly with our MAT Navigator, is that what we'll want to establish is what's the referral pathway to make use. I think you might be aware, too, Discovery Behavioral Health and has kind of merged with Safe Harbor. They've kind of taken over Safe Harbor after Ford's retirement. And so, you know, that program is kind of, you know, going through some change too. And, you know, we'll want to talk with them particularly, and I'm not sure, I haven't touched base with them about how they envision potentially also kind of interfacing with that facility.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Just thank you so much, Joe. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, no, we all appreciate, I think really the medical staff and, you know, all the staff really appreciates the support that you all showed to the team. So thank you.
We certainly do support you. You do wonderful, valuable work. Thank you. And your reports are very interesting and very thorough. And we thank you for them, Dr. Madden.
Welcome.
And for all the work that you do for us.
Thanks.
All right, then we'll go on to board business. And the first is Board of Health report from Dr. Call.
All right. Let's see. The Board of Health typically meets before our board meets, but that's not true this week. So I can't report about the meeting that we're going to have tomorrow. All I can say is that there'll obviously be a detailed update on the pandemic from Dr. Berry. There's also going to be a lot of discussion and a proposal with regards to the Community Health Improvement Plan, CHIP, and the Board of Health Oversight. I don't know the specifics of that yet, but I'm sure that will be a very important conversation. There's also going to be a large presentation by Anna McKerney on the Jefferson County Accessible Community Advisory Committee. There's some great work and some grants that have come through to make everything here in Jefferson County more accessible for those who have mobility challenges. And then we'll also be talking a lot about septic system repair replacement. And we've decided to postpone any further discussion about the climate crisis until January. But we have been getting a number of reports from Laura Tucker and Cindy Jane on the public health effects of the climate crisis, ranging from asthma and smoke problems to other hazardous problems caused by climate change. So that's all I have to report on the Board of Health. And then the next section, did you want to start this on the Climate Action Committee?
Yes.
Then I'll give a report. We had our first meeting yesterday.
Okay. Commissioner Koff, you were on that committee, is that correct?
That is correct.
Some time ago. And Commissioner Koff has been asked to, I guess the committee has reinstated itself?
No, the committee's been operating nonstop ever since I left close to 6-8 years ago, but I was on it for the first 6 years.
And he has been asked now to come back on the committee, and I would like to appoint him as our representative to the Climate Action Committee. He can make a report. He has already attended a meeting, but not as a representative. I'm asking for your endorsement for Commissioner Koff to be the board representative on the Climate Action Committee. And I don't see that we've got an action item on here for this, so we may not be able to make the formal action today, but I can appoint you, and then we can ratify it at the next meeting if that works for you.
Jill, on the special session notice, I did put on there that action may happen in regular session, so I don't know if that will work.
If I might add, Jill, the next meeting actually is not until February. And so whatever you decide is the best way to go forward. It might also be worth noting that Chris O'Higgins has been a very active member representing Jefferson Healthcare. And I just sent to all of the commissioners the Climate Action Committee organizational goals, which include some goals and some reports from Chris O'Higgins and the great work that we've done so far, Jefferson Healthcare, to reduce our carbon footprint.
All right. So, Mari, do you have a...
I just need to be reminded as to why, because Matt Reddy held this position before, why it was decided not to fill that position. I can't remember. Can you?
I think the issue was that they were looking for certain reports from Jefferson Healthcare, and many of them had to do with facilities and the reduction of our carbon emissions. And I think it was decided, and perhaps Matt could correct me on this, that Chris O'Higgins, as a staff person who's actually doing the work on the ground, would be a good choice for this. And he was interested in doing it. And now with the increased workload related to the master plan, he's been consulted and is actually delighted to be able to take a substitute, or a, what do you call it? A backup role.
A back seat.
Yes. And help when he's needed, but not have to attend the regular meetings and participate in what all the other organizations are trying to do.
Then explain how you were invited then to step up to this committee, Case?
Right. They have several people who are leaving the committee, and I've been in close contact and still know the people who have been running the meeting, the committee. And so they just approached me and said that there's a change. There may be a change in the leadership of the committee. Cindy Jane, who's the chair of the committee, is looking at stepping down. The current vice chair is leaving the committee and so will not be able to take her position. So she's actually hoping that I would agree to be the vice chair next year, this coming year, and the chair the year after that. But having spent a lot of time with the Climate Action Plan, which was developed when I was the chair of the committee, they were hoping that I would come back and help at this point.
All right. Is there any discussion? Yes, Bruce.
So before, was it a board appointed committee position? Or, you know, I mean, I think we need to decide whether it's going to become a board committee appointed position again, or whether, like with Chris on there, whether it's just a hospital district representative.
Well, I think that's a good point. It was a board appointed position at that time. That was quite some time ago. And but then the way it evolved, it's coming around again to be a board appointed position if Chris Perhaps we should put this aside and look into it a little deeper, because there's a possibility that maybe another commissioner might want to also be considered for it. And if we will be sorting out committees at the 19th, at the meeting of the 19th, and we can go over those things then. And we'll delay that if the board agrees to that.
Yeah, I think, and I would like Commissioner Reddy maybe to remind me. I've got a feeling it was something to do with that that he did not have the control, being in a governance role as a board member. He didn't have any. Didn't have any say in what we did, what the hospital district did. I can't remember, and maybe say Commissioner Reddy can remember why he thought it was difficult for him to work in that direction.
Do you want to respond to that, or?
I thought Commissioner Kolf pretty much captured it. It seemed Chris Higgins was a better fit, so we just switched it to be an operational role.
Okay. All right. Well, let's put this in the perspective then of all of the assignments that we'll be making on the 19th, and then we can make sure everyone is represented where they need to be. We'll delay that until then.
That's fine with me. Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. Is there any other board business?
Well, this is and this isn't, but to carry on from climate change, I listened to a very interesting piece on the Canadian Broadcast Corporation this morning regarding the lack of peat bogs and peat areas of peat that have been removed from, I guess this was in Canada, but it's also been done here. Which captures a lot of carbon. I guess peat bogs captures a lot of carbon, which has been essential in the past for helping with the climate change. And I don't know, Case, if you're going to be a representative, it might be interesting for you to find that. It was and listen to it. I found it quite interesting. Is how and we can get these peat areas back as long as they're not built on by just putting water on them instead of draining them all, just watering them. And that might go a long way to assisting, instead of planting trees, which peat apparently captures much more carbon than trees do. So just to send you on your way, Case, maybe it's worth looking into.
Maybe we should put some peat up on our green roof, which I look down on regularly when I go for my dermatology visits.
We're getting a little off. So let's go back, and I see a hand up for Matt.
Yeah, thanks. I just have a logistical question. The last time we had a meeting at Port Ludlow, administration did not bring recording equipment, and I was sort of shocked that for some reason that decision was made, so the meeting was not recorded. As well, I was kind of shocked. I was asked by administration not to record it myself before the meeting with the board chair. I found that very odd. I just want to know, at our next Port Ludlow meeting, is there some intention to not bring recording equipment and record our meeting? And if so, is that appropriate for that decision to be made without the whole board being involved?
I don't think that has been a decision. We haven't done that in the past because of logistical considerations, but I think we could talk about this another time.
Well, the January 12th meeting is our next meeting. I just want to know if it's going to be recorded or not.
The policy states that special meetings aren't required to be recorded. So it would take a board action to go outside of that policy. So Matt, we were complying with the board policy with respect to recording of board meetings.
Okay, I don't think that's true. If you check the policy, all it says is the board may record meetings. And we made that because we wanted to be able to meet with elected officials and not be obligated to bring a recorder. It was not so people could whimsically decide not to record some meeting.
We will.
That's not my recollection. That we
can check the board book. It says you may. I mean, it does give us the option to not record any meeting. I just didn't realize it would be exercised by the. I assume the whole board would be involved if we were going to decide not to record a meeting.
Typically, we have not recorded special meetings when we go to Chelan or we go elsewhere. We have not recorded them because it is logistically difficult to do that. So we can.
Can I make a motion that we record our meeting on January 12th?
Yes, of course you can make any motion you would like. Is there a second to that motion?
I'll second it.
All right, discussion. Is there any discussion?
Well, aren't we back to it wasn't on the agenda? This is a special meeting.
Good point. That's an excellent point, and we cannot make any kind of action other than what is listed in this agenda. So
I do have another question.
Yeah.
When we have special meetings, they're not necessarily audio recorded, but there is a record of the meetings, isn't there?
Yes. There's okay. A minutes of the meeting.
We comply.
But they're not recorded.
Public Meeting Act, Bruce.
Well, I knew we did, but you know, even in the Public Meetings Act, it doesn't say you have to audio record a meeting. Just have to have a.
We comply with all of the regulations. We send information well in advance to all of the newspapers, to anyone who requests the agendas. And that we notify them of when the meetings will be, where they will be, and how to assess them. So the public is always welcome to come to any meeting that we have, unless it's executive session. That's the only time the public is not allowed. But otherwise, okay. Every
the
meeting.
Is a special meeting. We've recorded many special meetings in the last year. And so I think it's very whimsical to
on-site.
Say we're not going to record.
On-site.
Yeah, but that's just whimsical. The policy doesn't say we don't record off-site meetings. It just gives us the ability to actually not record any meeting. But anyways, is the administration going to record January 12th or not? I just would like to know.
I would say at this point we would probably not, because of the logistics involved. We don't have any control over some of the areas and circumstances surrounding the meeting. We don't know. So my interpretation of what we had discussed in the past and why we don't do that is that we would not record it. But like I say, the public is welcome. And one of the things I was going to do is remind everybody that on the 12th of January, we have a retreat at Port Ludlow. On the 19th of January, we're having an election and board book meeting, special meeting. And then we will have our regular meeting on the 26th. So everyone is welcome to come. Yes.
I just want to clarify, there will be a record of the meeting. There just won't be an audio recording of it. Okay, thank you.
It's always a record. Always. Case, yes.
I'd like to bring up a different topic, if I might. I did send to the commissioners the link, and I also sent it to Mike and a few other folks. A link to a video that Those of us who attended the Institute for Health Care Improvement monthly meeting this morning, absolutely fabulous. It's only 14 minutes long, and it's a TED Talk that was given by Heather McGee, who is the author of a book entitled The Sum of Us. And her TED Talk back in 2019 is titled, Racism Has a Cost for Everyone. And I guess I'm just urging that all of us and all staff who are interested at all, take a look at this 14-minute video, because it really does say an awful lot about racism and its impact on entire communities, not just marginalized communities, but white communities, everyone. So anyway, just want to highly recommend it.
Would you please send an email to us and give us the...
He did already.
Yes, I did.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
All right. All right, then. If there's no more board business, we will go to the meeting evaluation. Bruce, you're in the upper right-hand corner of my screen, left-hand corner of my screen. You want to go first? The evaluation.
Well, I'm glad we had it a week early rather than on whatever, Christmas Eve or Christmas. I mean, like always, I mean, really good reports, fabulous financial report. Dr. Mattern always has a good report, you know, the safety and quality. I mean, you know, the letter that Tina read, I mean, it's all good. You know, so, but amongst us, we never always agree on everything, so that's normal. So it was like our normal meetings that we've had. I mean, overall, really good meeting.
Okay, Matt.
Good meeting, good information. That's all I have to say right now.
Okay, Maury.
I would agree with the two gentlemen who just spoken. Excellent.
Case?
Yes, they packed an awful lot of information into a reasonable amount of time. And I thought the educational session on the strategic plan was also very important, as well as our affirmation of the work we're doing, heading towards being more generative.
Okay, and I concur with all of you. So then at this point, we will go into executive session. We are concluding our business meeting. And before that, though, I want to wish everybody a happy holidays out there. And Mari, you've got your hand up.
I wondered if we were going to take a short break before we go into executive session. But I also would like to thank Mike and SLG for donating their bonus to UGN. Mm. They've all independently, I guess, and together decided to do that. And I think they've worked and carried the burden as everybody else in the organization. I realize that that's a very generous decision they made. So I thank them all very much. Okay. For our community, they're just so community-minded. It's just, can't say enough.
Okay. Thank you for that, Maury. All right. We are concluding our business meeting. We will take a 10-minute break. And return at 25 after 5. And then we will go into executive session to discuss the performance of a public employee.
Do we have to come back here first and then go, right?
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah, come back to this link first.
Come back here first and then go into
session. Great.
Executive session, we will return to regular session at 5:55 and no action will be taken. Did you get this? Did the recording start before I begin speaking, Alyssa, or should I repeat?
I think you should probably repeat. It looked like it was spinning for a second. Also, just confirming the action will not be taken.
Yes.
Or action will be taken.
It is now 5:25 p.m. and we are beginning executive session. As soon as we get to our executive session link, we will return to regular session at 5:55 and no action will be taken. So board members, please reconvene on the link provided by Alyssa. Okay. Thank you.